Steve couldn't be here today, so you were going to be stuck with an avian ecologist giving a talk about marine mammals. So fasten your seatbelts. So why are we giving this talk? The reason that I was inspired to think about this was a comment both by the panel, but also by others, saying that perhaps pinnipeds are limiting recovery of southern resident killer whales, or that if you provide more fish for them by presumably limiting fisheries, that might result in, that may not result in more fish available to killer whales because the pinheads will intercept them. So let's look at, let's look at the evidence. And so to set context, I thought we should just quickly review what we know about killer whale diet, and we don't need to talk about that much as we talk about that at length here. But we know that the May through September diet is dominated by large Chinook, and then also what Mike Ford presented yesterday. Other months also have a fair amount of Chinook as well. The killer whale distribution, if you look at where the samples are collected for diet for killer whales, you find that they're mostly, when they're in the inland waters, mostly at the southern end of Vancouver Island and also off the San Juan Islands. And that also fits with where we see the distribution of the animals as well in the inland waters. But also keep in mind that their killer whales are spending time on the outer coast as well, and at times a significant portion of the time is spent out there. So let's look at the three pinnipeds that overlap with killer whales in terms of their range. And let's just think about if you're going to have competition, you need to overlap in space and time and a niche. And then there has to be competition, and then ideally you would have some sort of cost to that competition in terms of fitness cost. And keep that in mind as we're going through these slides. And so what I thought I would do is talk about what's happening to the populations in terms of their trends, and then quickly talk about do they overlap in space and time, and are they eating the same things or not. So in general, I think Eric has pretty well covered this. Populations went up starting in the 1970s with the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and you tend to see a lot of curves like this for harbor seals. So they went up initially and plateaued in most cases in the early 1990s. The top graph there is for the Strait of Georgia, and then the bottom graph is for other index sites in BC. And what you notice here is a little bit of a different pattern in that the population appeared to have plateaued much more recently in other index sites in BC than in the Strait of Georgia. If we look at Washington, both inland waters or coastal waters, you see the same shapes to the curves, and there's an indication that actually harbor seals reached carrying capacity, and that occurred in the early to mid-1990s, and perhaps even earlier in Oregon, in terms of reaching carrying capacity and stabilizing. But I should point out, we don't have recent data, particularly south of BC. And so we don't really have very good data points further on. So we don't know what happens after those points. And Eric talked about that. So do they overlap in terms of where they are spatially? And then does the diet overlap with killer whales? Well, if you look at the haul-out sites throughout the range, they overlap completely with harbor seals do with southern resident killer whales. If you look at where they actually spend their time foraging, and the data on this is very spotty. There's recent work by Alejandro and a bunch of his students, particularly for the San Juans, in terms of where these animals spend their time foraging. And you find that an awful lot of the animals are not actually foraging in the areas where the killer whales are foraging. They're foraging in different places. So what are they eating? Well, in the Strait of Georgia, according to Lisiak's 1993 paper, salmon compose about 1.3 to 8.6% of the diet for harbor seals. But we don't have any final resolution to that, so we don't know what species of salmon. And then there's the more recent work that we've been doing with Alejandro and his students. And it suggests, actually, if we look at frequency of occurrence data, this is not percent in diet. This frequency of occurrence of hard parts in the scat, we find that the frequency of occurrence of salmon varies from about 4% all the way up to 51%. That's of salmon in general. And nearly all of that salmon is consumed in the fall. But then if we actually identify the hard parts to species, we find that actually Chinook represent a very small percent of those samples that were identified as species. And then there also is now fatty acid work being done by Bromgarten, et al. So this work I'm presenting was actually just published today in METS. And then there's the Bromgarten et al. Work, which has been submitted. That's the fatty acid work. That suggests if you don't correct for fats, that Chinook is actually a bigger part of the diet. But actually, if you correct for fats, it's actually a very small part of the diet. And what that suggests is actually you have to eat very little Chinook, which is very fatty, to contribute to your fats. You also have the same sort of issues of stable isotopes, but I'm not going to go into that. And then let's look at California sea lions. What's happening with their populations? They've been growing, and growing dramatically over time. But as was indicated, so if we look at the trends over time, it looks something like this, with some indication of perhaps stabilizing in more recent years. But we really need more data before we know that. But as was alluded to in the responses or the questions, the rookeries are way south of where the killer whales are. And a big part of the population is down there. And the population that comes up into the range of the southern whales and the killer whales is primarily male-based, and it's seasonal, so it's a pulse. And so you can look at Elysiak's work from 2010, and what we have here are haul-out sites. The bigger the circle indicates the greater number of animals. And these are seasonal. So we're starting in the top left panel with summer, then moving to fall, and then down to winter, and then down to spring. And you can see essentially no animals here in the summer. So no overlap at all in the summer. Shouldn't be any competition in the summer. But then there is a fair amount of overlap as you move into fall and other seasons. What are they eating? Well, we have the least amount of information on California sea lion diet for this area. And most of it's quite dated. If we look at, again, frequency of occurrence data, this is frequency of occurrence of hard parts in scat. This is not percent in diet. But we can see that the salmon in the diet ranges somewhere between 5 and 25% of the diet, and it's quite variable spatially and among years. But the vast majority of the diet was composed of pollock and whiting. Moving on to sellers. Population's been growing dramatically over time, and there's no indication that it's slowing down, at least that I'm aware of. So curves look like this. So we started Alaska at the top, going all the way down to Oregon at the bottom. They are just going up in numbers. So we're getting more of those over time. There's very little overlap in the inland waters of Washington with southern resident killer whales. There's considerable overlap on the west coast of Vancouver Island and other locations. So we can again look at Elysiak's plots. Same plots as we saw previously. Remember, this is top left is summer, fall, winter. Summer. Is that right? So what are the summer, fall, winter, spring.
There's a pointer there. It's going clockwise.
But it's also a typo in his figure caption. In the summer, not surprisingly, most of the animals are at the rookery. That's why you have that big giant circle up there at the top of Vancouver Island. And then as you move into fall, they get to become more spread out. You see considerable overlap with the killer whale. And then salmon, according to Lisiak's work, is about 10% of the overall diet, and it ranged between 7% in the spring to 15% in the fall. 84% of the consumption is occurring in British Columbia, and about 16% of that is occurring in Washington, and about 10% of that 16% is occurring on the Columbia River. And then less than 10% of the salmon being consumed by sellers is in the size class selected by southern resident killer whales, at least based on what we've seen in the selectivity presentations so far. So if you look at that bottom graph, that's the size classes that are selected by the sellers. And they seem to be selecting Chinook based on the availability, unlike killer whales. And then when we look at the salmon samples, a small percent of those salmon samples appear to be composed of Chinook. So overlap, yes. Diet, some. But not a lot of Chinook. So I guess what I'm trying to say is it's complicated. because you've got a lot going on in terms of overlap, and it varies temporally and seasonally, it varies by the animal you're talking about. But I think we need to consider what's happened to these populations over time. And do we have seasonal overlap? Do we have foraging spatial overlap? And keep in mind that a lot of the animals are in places beyond where the killer whales are. So some of them are up on river mouths. And so they're not really intercepting the fish that would be available to killer whales. Some of them are. So we need to put that in perspective. And then we need to think about how much diet overlap is there, both in terms of the composition of the diet, but also in the size class that's important to the killer whale. And then finally, I think we need to think about indirect effects. And that's where the food web modeling might be very helpful. Think about, keep in mind that the pinnipeds are eating things other than the salmon, and they also are eating predators of salmon. And so what are the indirect effects? Okay, so with that, I'll stop.
I mean, you kept emphasizing that you need to have space-time overlap, but I don't think that's true. That, for instance, if something else is eating two-year-old Chinook salmon in the ocean, then those are the salmon that will ultimately return in the size classes that would be of interest to the killer whales. Quick and dirty, it looked like about 2% of the Stellar's diet was Chinook, with 10% salmon and 20%. What does that work out to in terms of how many, say, two-year-old Chinook salmon or whatever age? Are we talking thousands, tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands? Do you know?
I don't know.
You don't know.
There are some biomass estimates in Elysiac's report. We could look at that. And I also meant to put, I thought about that same point shortly before I gave the talk, and I was actually going to quickly add a bullet. A lot of the data I presented didn't show the juvenile salmon that are being extinct. So there is that effect on the juveniles and ultimately on the overall population of salmon. Yeah.
Since you're an ornithologist, John Weems is probably one of your heroes. And John had a lovely paper in Bioscience. Gosh, it was probably in the 80s. I'm dating myself. But it was called On Competition in Variable Environments. And he made the point that it's very difficult to interpret overlap as evidence for competition. It could be evidence for no competition.
That's right. That's why he had that hierarchical approach. He had weak evidence to strong evidence. Yeah. So with the way he, as I recall, the way he put it was, first of all, you overlap in space and time or niche. And so that's weak evidence.
Right.
And then you actually see competition. He was actually thinking about behavioral competition.
Or strongest evidence comes from manipulating species.
That's
right.
And
observing.
And is there a fitness cost to that competition as well? And he has that whole hierarchy.
Well, then he was one of your heroes, wasn't he?
Yeah. I think that's a great paper.
Yeah. It does point out that these kinds of data, well, all kinds of species, are really difficult to interpret.
Yeah, and that's my point. Thank you.
Just a little comment on that too, because Ray kind of said what I had intended to say. Shame on you. I'm teasing. But you can also view it as sort of sequential intercepting fisheries. I mean, that's how you know Chinook salmon are managed, and so it may even be, if there's that much consumption, for example, in the winter off of California, the distribution of some of those California sea lions could conceivably be important too.
Yes, I guess I would just echo what Ray's comment was, that, you know, in some cases the indirect effects don't have to have a direct overlap in space and time to have an effect. But also I'm just wondering, for direct competition over, you know, adult sizes, are there any direct observation studies other than the ones at river mouths showing, you know, where in the spatial environment adult salmon are being consumed. So I'm aware of the direct observations on river mouths, but nowhere else.
Yeah, so there's been a fair amount of work recently where you have GPS units on an animal, you have a time depth recorder on the animal. And then part of, I think, Austin Thomas and others, or Austin, one of your students, looked at where are these animals actually foraging? And so not just where they are, but where are they when they're actually foraging? And the other thing you do is you force feed them a little pill, and you can change, look at the change in temperature, so you actually know when they actually capture something that they're eating. So you can look at not only where they are, but are they, and where they're diving, you can look where they are, when are they successful in capturing something. And those data are coming to light. But I haven't seen them in a way. One thing what I found complicated about those data is that it's not an unbiased representative sample of the population in terms of where they're foraging. Those were put on those animals to often look at specific questions. Is there an impact on this particular herring run, for example? Not in general, where the world of harbor seals spend their time foraging. And what you really want is that unbiased representative sample, which I haven't seen.
Okay.
But other people may know better data than I.
I could just say anecdotally, I do surveys off the northwest coast, and I see stellar sea lions capturing adult salmon. You know, in pretty much the same areas, I also see killer whales when we see them.
I guess I'm going to caution a little bit. We're focusing on adult salmon when the reality is we don't know what size selective nature is in the winter diet. The small sample size that you have indicates that there's a younger age class than what you see in the summer, as well as by age class of the population of southern northern whale, you see that juveniles eat smaller fish. And so the competition is got to be considered across the spectrum.
Sure. And it's like they vary over time. Yeah.
So I just make a comment that one of the components of question two that this correlation versus causation panel is meant to consider is how pinnipeds and other competitors for Chinook might affect the responses of southern resident killer whale changes in Chinook harvest. So to the extent that the folks on that panel can think about what they've heard and some kind of sensitivity analyses that might be done, you know, Don presented a lot of mechanistic analyses about what the caloric needs of killer whales are and how many they might consume, you know, 250,000 or whatever the number was. That kind of ballpark estimate for these other pinnipeds, or for the pinnipeds rather, would be, I think, helpful. I'm interested in that kind of thing.
I had a question. Do you have any sense of how much the error resulting diet might introduce into the problem? I mean, it seems like marine mammals that eat gadids and salmon, and we estimate the proportions based on frequency of occurrence, there's going to be some error there, right? Do you think that's important?
Yes.
Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I do. I haven't looked into that. I mean, it's not something I have done. I was looking at Elysiak's work where he's tried to correct for that. And what you generally find is that the percent in the diet, it varies. It can have dramatic effects in terms of the actual biomass consumed. Because you can be eating a lot of small things and have high frequency of occurrence, but it may not result in a great deal of the biomass that you consume, whereas you might eat one big thing and you'd have a smaller frequency of occurrence, but it may constitute a big biomass.
Thanks a lot.
That one thing, and that's also why we're moving to trying the fatty acid stabilisotope and also the genetics approach, and to provide complementary data. And so all of those parts are coming together.